You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Greetings and welcome, my friends, to another Wind Up podcast. Today we are talking about the small fishes in the big old ponds of the wine industry. This comes hot on the heels of a couple of events as well as some just industry happenings around Napa. I figured it's as good a time as any to dive into just a little bit of perspective around the wine industry. And it's something that we talk about quite a bit in terms of like how many cases or how many tons are produced. We've spoken a lot about, you know, just the size and kind of scope of like tonnage of grapes, how much that costs. And then also, you know, how much wine is produced per ton and things of that nature. So I want to continue this conversation this month with a little bit more insight into that. Before we dive in, number one, couple of announcements, a couple of things. Gosh, I am all over the place. I just got done with a bottling run on May 5th, plus all the work that was leading up to that. I'm a little frazzled. I'm a little sleep deprived. So if I stumble over a few things, bear with me a little bit this week. But the announcements are, one, thank you all so much again for tuning in, for subscribing, for listening, for sharing this with friends, colleagues, whoever that may be. Please continue to do so. And as always, if you have a brief moment to leave us a rating or a quick review, wherever you're consuming the podcast, that would be outstanding. Really helps with the search algorithm and getting the show out and about. Number two, please be sure to follow us on all of our social networks at MTGA Wines. You know him, I say him every show, the Book of Face, YouTube in particular, Instagram are probably the most popular of the bunch. You can also find us on the social network formerly known as X. Again, that's at MTGA Wines. Outside of that, let's go ahead and just dive right into things, shall we? Now, the perspective on this episode, I would say, comes hot off the heels of Premier Napa Valley, which for many of you that maybe don't know about that event, it's very similar to what used to be known as Auction Napa Valley, known as Napa Valley Collective. Premier focuses on really the wine trade, retail shops, restaurants, distribution, wholesalers. You know, we've been throwing around a lot of that verbiage over the last few weeks. And last week or 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, whatever it was now, is a big wine auction. It's a chance for some of these retailers, wholesalers, and folks to come into town and taste barrel samples of whatever wineries are slinging. There were about 160 different barrel samples to be tried at this event, which you definitely tell who hasn't been spitting and who is actually drinking all of those samples. It's painfully obvious. This tasting only also starts, I think, at like 9 or 10 in the morning. So you're going in hot and hard into some barrel samples bright and early. It is a hell of an event. And all the heavy hitters there. You know, insert big winery name, they're probably there. All the big names we've talked about, whether it's the Wagners, whether it's a Joseph Phelps or Silver Oak, whether it's the smaller, cultier guys. You see the who's who of the wine industry, and you see these wineries that are obviously massive in size and scale and scope, and you see the tiniest of tiny producers that are involved in this event. And it starts to provide a huge amount of perspective for, you know, where a lot of us fit into the wine industry. Because when you're also, you know, rubbing shoulders and elbows with some of the biggest wine merchants in the country, if not the world. So it's really, really interesting coming out of that event last week. And you have a few catch-ups. We continue to hang out with some colleagues through about Tuesday last week, about a week ago. And then even more so, I ended up at a dinner for one of the, you know, kind of the big name cooperages that a lot of folks use out here, because I've been buying their barrels personally for, gosh, 11 years now. And you end up sitting and just chatting and talking shop with all these colleagues and all these, you know, interesting people that range from someone like us that maybe makes 1,000-ish cases a year to folks that are making tens of thousands or hundreds or millions of cases of wine every year. And the really interesting thing about it is that everyone has kind of this beautiful perspective of that there's room for all of us. Just because you make tens of thousands of cases doesn't mean that the 1,000-case producer is any lesser than you are. There's a lot that goes into that, and I want to try and share some of that perspective and kind of insight from what, you know, what this experience was over the last week and a half of events and wining and dining. Some of you who do follow us on our social networks probably saw some of those events, probably saw some photos and some video from those things. It's kind of hilarious because it's a way that we can kind of share the goings on of what's happening in the Valley. It also looks like we're just partying the whole time and just having the best, you know, best life you could possibly live. I guarantee you, it's a lot of work. It's exhausting. It's why I think my right eye has been twitching for the last week. It's because I'm just still playing catch up. I'm going right from all those events right into a bottling run over the last few days. You get worn thin pretty quick. If you're watching this on YouTube, you might notice some bags under my eyes. That's just how the world works in this industry. So let's start kind of at the beginning with this, is that, you know, when you're walking through this event at Premier Napa Valley, it's actually something we'll likely be participating in next year as a small producer. It's interesting because, one, you know a lot of these people. That might not surprise some of you. We talk all the time about how small this industry is, despite how big the businesses themselves can be. There are a lot of huge personalities, you know, that walk around this room. There's a lot of people that literally make decisions that will make or break brands when it comes to how much wine they're going to be purchasing from that winery or from that business to be selling through their, say, retail chain or whatever the case may be. It's super, super interesting to hear kind of the rumblings and the goings on of, hey, did you hear this winery took price increases and now we can't just keep them on the shelf, you know, at a certain price point. We have to put them in a glass case, you know, for like display and like, you know, security purposes. That's going to impact wine sales at a retail level. Oh, did you see this person is now, you know, declassifying or making X amount more wine than they were specifically for this market? Did you hear that this is just some, you know, bulk wine project that's, you know, people are just buying people's leftovers and blending it, but hey, people love it and it can hit this price point. And you hear all these conversations going on. And as far as the wine industry goes, it's a little bit like seeing into the Matrix. Like you just, all of a sudden it starts to make a little bit more sense in terms of the size, the scale, you know, the scope of it, but also why so many of us can, you know, exist together. I mean, because there are a ton, and I mean a ton of small fish in the ocean of the wine industry, as you might expect. There are a few big blue whales out there that are commanding, you know, that presence. Whether you're talking about the Wagner family and Camus and Joe Wagner, what he did, you know, is doing with Copper Cane and Meiomi before that. Whether you're talking about the Silver Oaks, the Joseph Phelps, you know, and LVMH in particular that now owns Joseph Phelps. That's Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy for those that aren't sure what LVMH stands for. They purchased Joseph Phelps last year. Expand on that a little bit more here as we get into the show. Then you see folks like, you know, Spring Mountain Winery, Barnett Vineyards up on Spring Mountain as well, Tate Wines. You see, you know, you see some of the other big names. There are actually a few kind of key absences this year of folks that simply weren't participating anymore. And that can affect things. And there's a lot of, you know, rabble about, hey, these folks, you know, this lot went for so much money last year. You know, why are they not participating in the auction this year? And it can be things like, oh, there's a backdoor deal of, hey, we'll provide you a really great deal on our wine after the event so you can sell a whole bunch of it if you bid really high on our lot. Those are the kinds of things that happen. It's a lot of, you know, a lot of theatrics as well, kind of at this kind of large scale. But it's just rubbing shoulders with all these individuals and hearing that. It's been some time. It's been quite a few years since I've attended this event. Have not participated in any way, shape, or form since probably 2014, maybe. And it is just it's a very interesting time. And what's really interesting is are all the folks, at least to me, and hopefully to you guys as well, is you have a lot of the folks that are in the industry in terms of sales, hospitality, things of that nature. But then you have those of us that actually make the wine, who are there, you know, trying to like showcase our wares for the world to see in this like really confined kind of finite moment of like, hey, here's anybody and everybody you would ever want to talk to in the wine industry. And they are going to be all in one room for like 6 hours and go. And by the way, you're going to see that we're going to do this like 2 days in a row. So go have fun, do your thing. It's a little wild. It's a little overwhelming. It's a little crazy. And for me coming out of that event and I've been talking with Brittany about this over the last week, there's kind of this letdown, at least for me, because as a small producer, and I think there are a few of us that kind of feel this way, that you're like, how do I fit into this enormous world of wine? You know, how do I, you know, make what we do on such a small scale make sense within this grand scheme of things? And sometimes you get snapped right back to reality. Because shortly after the events on Tuesday, we were up on Howl Mountain with some really good friends up at Almacero, an amazing place. We got to know Frank, their owner, over the course of kind of the festivities. Super nice dude. The wines are fantastic. Their winemaking team, Matilda, and they do have Francoise Pichon come in and help them out with some of the winemaking as well. She's just some of the nicest people, some of the most talented people you can find. And you kind of get snapped back to it of like, hey, we're the small producers. We're focusing on quality, not quantity. We're here kind of for each other. It's not like you're having to have like a therapy session or anything, but it is this, you start to remember again, like, hey, this is why we do this. And yeah, being small within this industry is not a great way to make a buck, but damn it, it's a lot of fun. And we're going to, you know, focus on that is we get to have a really good time. We get to do what we want to do on our terms. And if people are willing to support us in that endeavor, then, you know, we can't be more thankful, basically. It's pretty much how the like recovery after these big events go is you there are a lot of questions floating around your head of like, shoot, you know, why do we do this? How do we do this? You know, are we doing this the right way? Because you interact with so many people that are the big fish, you know, in the room, that are the whales in the room. And you're like, man, if we could, there's a little bit of that envy. There's a little bit of maybe that jealousy and that, man, what if we could be like that? And those comparisons start creeping in slowly but surely. And it can be really tough as a small producer to be that little fish and say, hey, we're doing what we want to be doing. We're doing the right thing. We think on our terms, people love it. And we're going to continue doing that until we can't anymore. That is kind of the perspective that you have to have. But it is really tough to see that forest through the trees. And here's another reason why. Is we get through those events, we kind of calm down a little bit, and I end up at this barrel dinner for the Sylvain Cooperage, the Sylvain family. They're someone that I've been buying barrels from, as I mentioned at the beginning, for 11 years now. They're a great linchpin in our program. They don't work for everybody, but typically they try and barrel producers do this. They do try and wine and dine us quite a bit, where we'll go out to dinner. go out to lunch during harvest, they'll bring us pizza, which is shout out to Evan at Nadalier. We appreciate you because when you're fried and you just need something, anything to eat, sometimes you just need someone to help take care of you. And a lot of these folks do a really great job of that. And of course, you're spending quite a bit of coin, which is incentive for them to take care of you. But, you know, such is life. I mean, even back here we have, and there's one more in my truck. I mean, shoot. We got some Cooperage hats and swag and stuff that, you know, you get tossed. Some of you have probably seen me out at the winery in my green winemaker vest from Sylvan, actually. So, you know, we get wine and dine. There's some nice perks to buying, you know, these expensive ass French oak and American oak barrels and things. But realistically, you know, it is, you know, it's kind of business and you have to do what you need to do that's best for your program. Anyway, I digress. So this dinner comes around, I think, like every other year they try and do it. Maybe it is every year. I've missed it the last couple of years. I think the last time I was there was probably 2021 or 2022. And luckily, I've known their kind of main California sales rep for a long, long time. In fact, my folks used to buy barrels from them. And still do in small quantities. And I place my very, very small order of about 3, maybe 4 barrels a year through them. You know, I am definitely the small fish in the big ass pond, because of course at this dinner I end up sitting next to some folks from the Joseph Phelps team, which were amazing to talk to. Really, really interesting. But, you know, they buy about 400 or so of their barrels. So I'm, you know, 1% of their overall purchase. And what was kind of funny is, oh, those of us at the table, you know, a lot of us work for small producers or more medium size, I would say. And we all looked at him and we're like, hey, thank you for help, you know, inviting us out to dinner tonight. We appreciate you putting this on your tab. Because, you know how much over the last couple of weeks, you ought to know by now how much I love the math. So if you're buying 400 barrels at, you know, call it 1200 a pop, give or take. I mean, you're talking close to $500,000. They're probably getting a little bit of a deal if you're buying in bulk like that. I would hope so anyway. But, you know, that's a purchase just for one of their cooperages. And I guarantee you they have quite a few more. Because if you multiply that 400 barrels times, you know, the amount of cases, you're getting about 9,500 cases of wine out of that. And Joseph Phelps, as an example, I mean, you can find this online, so I'm not, you know, divulging any secrets here. You know, they probably make somewhere around, you know, 90,000 cases. So 10% of their production, you know, goes into their barrels, which is a good chunk. Now, if you take that and you put it into perspective for ourselves, about probably 7 or 8% of our production goes into Sylvan barrels. So, you know, same, right? Just different scales we're talking about. Obviously one quite a bit bigger and us being quite a bit smaller. So that's what I'm telling myself is, hey, about 10% of my annual barrel purchasing goes to you guys, just like Joseph Phelps. Like, what are you worried about? You know, those are the fun, you know, conversations we get to have as soon as we all kind of get to know each other. When you're sitting around a dinner table like that, you can speak very candidly with your colleagues about who you are, what you do, the amount of barrels you utilize, how many tons you crush every single year. And that perspective starts to really kind of, you know, seep in. You know, for me, it does add to a little bit of my imposter syndrome of like, oh, I buy 3 barrels a year, maybe 4, and I'm invited to this dinner. Like, why? I should not be here. Like, there are other people that should be sitting in this chair. You know, I appreciate the invite, but let's be realistic here. I'm probably a rounding error in your budget. So let's take that for what it is. That said, I'm very, very appreciative of it. It was a lovely, lovely dinner. And the wines we got to try as barrel samples and finished wines that were aged in some of their barrels were fantastic.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
You know, some of the perks of the winemaking gig is you get wined and dined a little bit from time to time. So all that kind of being said, kind of all the coming and goings of the last week and a half, going on 2 weeks, you know, going right into this bottling run, you know, which if you're listening to this on March 6th or 7th, we're talking in the last 48 hours, we bottled up about 300 cases of wine. So keep in mind, 300 cases, you know, that is way less than, say, that Joseph Phelps number. It's maybe on par with someone like an Almacero, who we did Taco Tuesday with, you know, about a week and a half ago. It's very, very interesting. And then, you know, my mind starts spiraling of like, okay, well, who else are the other big players? Like the big names that you see. And of course, you know, at Premier Napa Valley, you see David Duncan of Silver Oak walking by. And you're like, oh yeah, they make probably about 200,000 cases or so under Silver Oak, not including Tumi, not including Ovid, which they purchased, you know, what was it, 7 years ago or so. You have, I don't think I saw any of the Gallows there, but you do, you know, you do put that in perspective. Like, okay, well, they make about 80 million cases of wine a year. So with that, you're like, okay, where do I fit into this? You know? So, I mean, if we on a really good year make, I have to do the math now because I'm thinking about it. This is how squirrel brain, I mean, you all know by now, I got a little bit of the squirrel brain thing, but when I start thinking numbers, I'm like, God, I just want to know. So if you really wanted to know like our production size, we are, now let me multiply that by 100 because that'll give us the actual percentage. We are 0.0015% of Gallo's overall production. They probably spill more wine on a daily basis than we make. Hopefully not, but you know, it's a decent chunk. So you have like all of this stuff kind of rattling around your head over the last, you know, week and a half and change. And it can be really tough. It can be really, really tough. I've had a very tough time personally just over the last week kind of, you know, processing, you know, who we're talking to, the conversations we have. You know, of course, you meet some great friends. You have a great time. You do get to wine and dine a little bit and just kind of take a deep breath and relax. But you still have kind of the intrusive thoughts kind of keep creeping in of, you know, some of the big names and the people that you know and how this industry operates and kind of who it favors typically when it comes to producers, because there is traditionally kind of a certain way wine businesses have operated for centuries, in essence. And this whole direct-to-consumer thing with like wine clubs and all that stuff is incredibly new, like over the last 30 years new. This is not like a, hey, this is how wineries have operated forever. For those of you that have been in and around wine for a while, that's a great perspective to have, is that, hey, what we do today, how we travel around and do dinners and events and how we operate is completely different than what we would do 10 years ago, even, you know, shoot, even more so 20 or 30 years ago. And even if you go further back, you know, Napa wasn't really an up-and-coming wine region until the 1970s. You're talking 50 years, maybe 60s on a really good day after Prohibition. That's how young just Napa is as a wine industry. So this is the kind of stuff, you know, we start, and I think a lot of us start trying to think about and grasp. And it's really easy to be that small fish who's a little bit more of the artist. You're doing it for the romance and for the quality, and you're kind of doing it very selfishly, unabashedly for yourself. It kind of goes back to, we did a little bit of a highlight on a couple other podcasts. I believe it's Andrew Huberman podcast when he had Rick Rubin on it. This is a few episodes ago where we're talking about, you know, what makes like a task or a goal or something worth it. And Huberman, you know, kind of being more the scientist, is like, well, obviously we have to define like what worth it means. And there has to be some sort of, you know, something there that we can like measure. And Rick Rubin's response was like, well, worth it kind of implies that there's some sort of gain, whether that be monetary or otherwise. And which would mean in theory that you're relying on other people to, you know, like whatever it is you're kicking out, whether it's wine or music or whatever. And his kind of overarching point was, if you focus on that and only that, then what you're doing is in essence a kind of a waste of time. Because once you produce something in an artistic manner, whether or not people like it is not up to you, the producer. It's up to them as a subjective opinion and individual. So that's something that over the last few days, I've been trying to kind of reorient myself as, you know, one of these small fish in this giant pond of wine producers. That, hey, it's okay just to do what you do and do it really, really well. And frankly, that's, you know, my goal every year. It's simply to make the best wine we can from the vineyards that we work with. And if things change, we can adapt and overcome those challenges to make sure that we can continue to make some of the best wines that we can. You know, sitting next to, you know, some of the Joseph Phelps team and seeing, you know, shaking hands and catching up with guys like Kirk Vanghi at that dinner last week, you know, who has his hands in a lot of different wine projects, including his own Vanghi Vineyards. I've known him for a long, long time. And it can be really tough to sit there and be like, the art form is the right way to do it, or it's the way that I still want to do it, because you see kind of the commercial success of the names and how they have evolved over the years. And all of a sudden, being that small fish gets really, really challenging, because you realize that there's a lot of bigger ones out there, and there's a pretty decent chance that you could just get eaten up or be completely ignored because people are trying to catch the big fish. They're not worried about the small fish as much. They want to throw those back, right? And that's, you know, this weird analogy that I've had kind of like floating around my head over the last week or so. And then you get to our bottling run over the last couple of days. So we roll, this would have been Saturday. Let's see, let me make sure I have my dates right. So this would have been Saturday, March 2nd. Myself, along with a couple of newer friends, actually. Shout out to Dr. Phi and Chuck for coming out and helping me in the cellar on Saturday. It was a killer time of basically just diving in and saying, hey, here's what we do as we're preparing for bottling, which for us is, you know, lining up the barrels that we want to bottle. We're pumping all those wines out of those barrels into larger vessels to put the blends together. That way we can get some of those filtered for like our white wines and Brittany's rosé on Monday, and then get them bottled on the 5th, on Tuesday. So there's kind of just a intense few days of getting that lined up and ready to go. And even though you're only bottling 300 cases, there's still, you know, the way the properties, many of you have who listened to this, I know have been to the winery, have heard me describe it. But basically, for those that maybe haven't been out, you know, the winery building is close to, you know, 200 yards or so away from the cave where we store the barrels. So it's a matter of like transporting things on multiple runs back and forth, which can take you a couple of hours just doing that. And then, you know, on, gosh, it would have been Friday, March 1st, I spent 5 hours just by myself cleaning things. You know, that was where I get to be a janitor for the day. And it's all of it's days and days of work, long days. I mean, our bottling day between getting started, I was out at the winery a little bit before 6 a.m. on the 5th. I think I left the winery around, you know, just after 5. So it was close to that 12-hour day of just heavy lifting, cleaning stuff. It's cold. It's rainy. The conditions are miserable. It has rained like every February, March bottling run for us for like the last 3-4 years. It's been super, super obnoxious. But you start to bring, you have these blends that you brought up to tank. You're tasting kind of your final draft before things get bottled. You're looking at everything from the color of the wine to how it's particularly how it smells, how it tastes, of course. And you're just like, okay, now we got to put it into a bottle and slap a label on it and hope we did everything right. Like you see, there's a lot of confidence you have and like, we know it's ready. Let's go ahead and do it. But you're still bottling is such a god-awful mess 9 times out of 10 that you still, there's this like skepticism of actually getting through it. But you see those wines, you know, the bottles moving onto the line, getting filled up, getting corked, you know, labeled, put back into their cases so they're ready to go. You taste some of the end result, and because you as the wines are going into the bottling line, you do kind of a final tasting to make sure they're what you want them to be. So the guy, Chris, shout out to Chris and Ultima Bottling who helped us out. he literally brings me a bottle of wine that's open. He hands it. He's like, here's your sample. You take a swig of it and you say, all right, we're good to go. Or, hey, let's pull another round a little bit more through the line to make sure that whatever wine was in there previously, or maybe you're just starting, you got to get the water out of there. Let's make sure that that's all out and cleared out, and then we'll move in. And he does, luckily, he does a great job of making sure that that's all dialed in. So you take a swig of that sample and you're like, all right, here's the approval. Let's do this. Let's knock it out. And you get to see kind of the culmination of that art form, you know, as these bottles are just going by on this machine. And you start to, I don't know, it's kind of this nice peace of mind or understanding that the kind of the comparisons of, you know, why am I at this wine dinner? You know, they buy 400 of these barrels. I buy 3 of them. I'm at this big auction event. In fact, we're only volunteering. We're not even participating in the auction this year. We probably shouldn't even be here. And we're rubbing shoulders with the who's who, you know, of this industry, you know, both from the sales and like wholesale distribution side of things, but also the wineries that are involved in and around Napa. And it can lead to a little bit of that, you know, imposter syndrome, and just maybe, that comparison gets to be overwhelming. It can be really, really tough. I'm not going to lie. I've had a couple of bad days over the last week, really trying to come to terms with it. It's something that I always have struggled with, forever, as long as I can remember. This is a feeling that I'm very familiar with. And I always kind of find a way out. And I'm never actually sure when I will. But something as, you know, as hard and as tough and as challenging as a bottling run can be, and as stressful as it is, ask Brittany and next time you see her. Shoot, I am not one to be toyed with on a bottling day. I am a ball of stress and just a mess. I'm trying to make things happen as efficiently and as perfectly as I can, and I have no time for no nonsense. I'm a pretty terrible person on bottling day. But you finally get through that and you're cleaning up after the day. You're making it look like nothing had happened. You should see the winery right now. It's spotless. I'm pretty damn good at cleaning things, as it turns out. So if this wine thing doesn't work out, I'm going to be a great janitor. I'll tell you that much. My office, everything, for those of you watching on YouTube, it looks organized. You should see what's not in the camera view here. It's a disaster. I'm clean when I need to be. But yeah, I got some filing and some paperwork I got to take care of. Anyway, it's, you see that kind of, it always kind of shakes me out of it. So I get home, you know, after the bottling run yesterday, it's a long day. I grab a bite to eat. Brittany had gone to a local taqueria, got me a great torta that I was able to dive into. And I just sit there and you just kind of, I don't know, you get that perspective kind of comes back a little bit. You stop kind of comparing yourself to who the big guys are, who the big names are, and what maybe you should or shouldn't be doing. Because you still get to do what you want to do. And for the team at Joseph Phelps, I know that they get to do what they want to do. They're killing it. You know, a lot of these folks, the folks that I talk to are newer there. Because they're part of the new regime that's there after the LVMH purchase. And many of you who have listened to this know of Joseph Phelps and Insignia and Bacchus and the wines they've been creating for decades, and how kind of, you know, iconic they are within this industry. So just because of their a much larger size, they're like, there's no shade. They make, to be able to produce that quality of wine at scale is a very tough thing to do. It's a very tough thing to do. Man, my brain is, that one slipped out. It's a very tough thing to do. And good on him, man. It was interesting talking to him and the equipment that he has and how much of, you know, what they can do that's kind of automated that allows them to make, you know, the volume of wine that they do. And in essence, you know, have kind of like a 9-to-5-ish job for a lot of their employees rather than, you know, the 16 or 18 hours that, you know, us more analog producers deal with. And granted, you know, if it's the head winemaker out there, you're there much longer than 9-to-5. It's going to be a much longer day for you no matter what. But it's, I mean, the fact that you have part or a significant chunk of your seller team being able to clock out after 8 hours when you're making maybe around 90,000 cases a year, hey, good on you. That's impressive. My harvest schedule is way crazier than that. It's way crazier than that. And I don't even make 10% of what they make. You know, I make a little over 1% of their annual production, which is kind of crazy to think about. So, you know, you get this little bit of perspective. You realize that being the small fish in the big pond is just fine. You know, there is plenty of room for all of you, as it turns out. And probably the most important thing that you gather from this, once you can shed all of the nonsense in terms of the comparisons and am I doing the right thing, once you can kind of block that noise and the intrusive thoughts out, it's that the camaraderie in this industry, from every perspective, if you've been in it for more than a few years or it's something you've been interested in for a long, long time, is that no matter where you turn, you find an incredibly passionate group of people who are, frankly, just insane enough to do what we do and continue forward. It turns out a lot of the big fish like talking to the small fish, and vice versa. It's a very, very great community to be a part of. And man, yeah, once you get to this point, you can see that forest through the trees again. You're just thankful to be a part of it. All right. Enough of my random ramblings. That has been an episode of the Wind Up Podcast. I thank you all for tuning in. I hope this episode provide a little bit of kind of perspective on like the grand scheme of, you know, what we go through and who we chat with and how big of a deal it can be. But at the same time, we're just fermenting grape juice. And whether you've got a bunch of optical sorters or you're just working on a sorting line, doing it by hand, whether you're making 200,000 cases or you're making 200 cases, it's an interesting industry for everybody to be a part of. And when you go through the peaks and valleys of the last like week and a half, man, that perspective is hard to find sometimes. But it's there. You just got to be able to be patient and it'll come to you. No doubt about it. Thank you all so much for tuning in again. Be sure to hit us up on our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's on YouTube, Instagram, the Book of Face, the social network formerly known as Twitter. Be sure to like, rate, review, subscribe to the podcast for regular updates. And we will see you next week right here. Cheers.